Blog Talk Radio.
Zero, longitude zero, planned by the Creator. Sesanthropus was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland, Africa. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now we give you Africa, the center of the world.
Historical landmark. Our tour through these hallowed halls will be conducted
by the First Lady.
And your white great grandfather sold my great grandfather, and your white grandfather raped my grandmother, and your father stole, cheated, lied, and robbed my father. What kind of a fool would I have to be to say, come, my friend, to the white daughter and son?
Good evening, America. This is your president. Please listen carefully to the announcement I'm about to make. After careful consideration and research, Vice President Duke, Congress, and myself have concluded that black people have not advanced technologically. Their educational testing scores are on a rapid decline. The vast majority of them are on welfare and producing babies at a faster rate than they can support them, and we will not carry them anymore. We are left with no other choice but to put slavery back into effect. All blacks will report to the designated camps in their area to receive further orders. The only blacks excused will be those serving in the United States military and the police. Any blacks who do not cooperate will be terminated immediately. I repeat, slavery is back in effect.
We are at war! That's what I told you. I know you heard what the president said, and if the nigga don't move, then he's dead. It's time for us to take the stand. Woman to woman and man to man. Blood rushes through your veins, you feel the fear. Who'd have thought that it could happen here? In the land of the free, home of the brave. The year's 95, you're a slave. When they first hear the news, press play and then rewind and review, but the message is clear. take it seriously. And then they said that I was crazy. Violence escalating, and it's sad to see so many brothers being killed by the enemy. Mothers and daughters and fathers and sons, why can't they see we couldn't win by the gun? I told you how to win, but now it's too late. The enemy's on the rise, and he feels your face. Greed is a weapon, technology section. The war drum is sounding, the tool is the record. The will and the skill of the black man, exact man, giving a hand to his brother man. A word to the wise, and I tell you once again, know your enemy from your friend.
Our society. You give them jobs, political jobs.
Paul, you missed the point. It's only the smart ones we move up.
That makes it even worse.
Oh, you know, we have to move them up. If we leave a smart one in the ghetto, he might develop into a leader against us. But if we raise him up into white society, we neutralize him. He feels compelled to try to act like us. He loses his identity and his racial anger, if he has it. He becomes alien to his brothers. They realize he sold them out and they grow to hate him. He becomes worthless to them and safe for us.
No, thank you. In fact, in his love for the creature comforts, except for his color, he's become one of us.
It's you liberals who have lifted them up, Howard.
Paul, you conservatives make a mistake. You can't afford to strangle hope in people. Without hope, people become dangerous.
No, Howard. You liberals have let them invade our society. You give them jobs, political jobs.
Paul, you missed the point. It's only the smart ones we move up.
That makes it even worse.
Oh, you know, we have to move them up. If we leave a smart one in the ghetto, he might develop into a leader against us. But if we raise him up into white society, we neutralize him. He feels compelled to try to act like us. He loses his identity and his racial anger, if he has any. He becomes alien to his brothers. They realize he sold them out and they grow to hate him. He becomes worthless to them and safe for us.
No, thank you. In fact, in his love for the creature comforts, except for his color, he's become one of us.
We welcome you to Africa on the Move. As your host, Brother Africa, it's always an honor and a privilege to speak to you and to speak truth to the powerful and the powerless. To hear to give you what you need, not necessarily what you want. We're going to speak truth to the power, and we invite you to do the same by calling in at 323-679-0841. 323-679-0841. We welcome your voice. The show is a voice for the voiceless. Like always, on Africa on the Move, we will introduce you to our political panelists and analysts, followed by what's going on in our world. Then we'll speak to our theme today, time music. Well, we're going to make a little adjustment for today's program. What we're going to do first and foremost, we have a special guest, our sister Camille, the Nap Roots Bookstore in Oklahoma. We will talk just a little bit about this whole importance of African bookstore and maybe what's going on with her bookstore and how we help build it. Follow that, we'll come back with our panelists and analysts for today's program, and we'll proceed. So that's our order for the day. But as we talk about today, the 20th day of October, we just would like to remind you some historical facts that took place during our history and our struggle. On this day, on the 20th day of this day in 1929, U.S. stock market crashed, plunging world into depression. Britain declared a state of emergency in Kenya to stop the Mau Mau rebellion. King Yala and 183 others arrested in 11,000 murder. This was in 1952. Just a little tidbit of some events that took place on this day as relates to your history and your struggle. So right now, what we're going to do, like always, we're going to get started with our party and continue to travel down this road of liberation. I'm Brother Africa, and come and join me. Right now, we're going to bring in our sister Camille. It's been a while since we had her. So we're going to ask you to briefly introduce yourself, and we're going to have a discussion on the importance of African bookstore and maybe the status of her current bookstore, Napa Roots Bookstore. Sister Camille, if you can hear us, we'd like to welcome you to Africa on the Move. Welcome, Camille.
Thank you very much, Brother Africa. I am Camille Landry. I currently live in Oklahoma City, and I am co-owner, along with Bamboshi Shango, of Nappy Roots Bookstore. When we opened about almost eight years ago, we were the only black bookstore in Oklahoma, and the next closest black bookstores were in Dallas, Texas, and Kansas City, Missouri. Shortly after we opened, a bookstore opened in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and then a second one opened here in Oklahoma City, although that one has since closed. We come and we go, many African bookstores in this country. Over the course of my life, which has been a pretty long time, I have to admit, African-American bookstores have been of vital importance, not only to me as an individual, but also to our movement. I remember as a teenager literally hanging out at Ellis Bookstore in Chicago, Illinois. Brother Ellis was a brilliant man, primarily self-educated. He referred to himself as an autodidact. Anyway, Brother Ellis would let people gather in his store, and we would talk, and we would debate, and we would argue, and we would talk trash, and we would plan, and we would organize. And when we were getting off base, Brother Ellis would say, here, read this. Come back and let's talk about it. You know? He would never tell us, hey, you're wrong. Your analysis is incorrect. He would say, read this and come back and let's talk about it. So we did a lot of reading because we did a lot of talking, because when you're 15 or 16 years old, you think that you know everything that there is to be known. So I credit Brother Ellis for much of my political education at that time, and a lot of the political education of other sisters and brothers in that city, young people who were enraged at the knowledge of the oppression that we were facing, but unable to come up with a way to overcome it. So this to me is what real leadership looks like. And, you know, I thought that that place was literally golden. It was a place that opened up doors to ideas and concepts and knowledge that had been hidden from me, because we darn sure are not taught those things in school. And in school, not only are we not taught about our own history, our own culture, our own economics and those things, we also are not taught about logical thinking. We are not taught about how to conduct effective research that uses non-traditional means. We are not open to a lot of different areas of knowledge and pathways of knowledge. One of the most important pathways of knowledge that I discovered at Ellis and elsewhere, including at the feet of my own elders in my own home, is the oral tradition is strong among African people. If you saw Alex Haley's Roots, and I'm dating myself on this one, but if you saw Roots, you learn the story of the griot, how an individual in a village in Africa would memorize the entire history of that people. He would memorize, he or she would memorize every person's own genome. You know, you are the child of so-and-so, who is the child of such-and-such, and so on, back many, many, many generations. In addition to that, the griot would also say, this was the summer of the great flood, or this was the year of the fires, or this was the year when we were attacked by such and such a people and we prevailed, but we lost the following. All the history, the knowledge, the brilliance, the wisdom of that group of people was memorized by the griot, who would then speak it into the ears of not only the young, but also the people who were responsible for the care, you know, for the running of that group of people, of that tribe of people. Okay, so the oral tradition is a really, really powerful thing. And in this modern day, we don't have people that we call griots, but we do have people who fill the griot mission, who through their language speak truth and wisdom and history and knowledge into the ears of both young and old. In many, many, many places in this country, many of our cities, many of our towns and villages, there is no such place where people can come together and learn from the griots of our community, learn from the elders, learn from the wisdom of our people. And so that was particularly the case in Oklahoma City. About the only thing Black people own in this town are a couple of clubs and a whole lot of churches. And those churches are speaking the truth that they know, but that truth is limited to things that fall under the heading of whatever their particular religion prescribes, and that is not enough. So when the opportunity opened, and it opened in a strange sort of way, a group of people were putting together a collective that they referred to as Black Wall Street. Black Wall Street being that area of Tulsa that was very wealthy, very successful, filled with Black people who were entrepreneurs of one kind or another. And of course, if you know about it, you know that it was burned to the ground about 102, 103 years ago now, by a group of angry white people who could not abide the notion of that many Africans owning wealth, setting their own path of self-determination. And we can talk about that another time. I've been on this show talking about the history of the Greenwood community and Black Wall Street and what happened to it on the day of that massacre. But anyway, I'm getting off the subject. So a group of people here in Oklahoma City formed a collective called the Black Wall Street Coalition, and they secured a fairly large storefront. And for only $25, you could buy 6 feet of wall space, you know, a little bit more than maybe 50 square feet, and you could sell whatever it was that you wanted to market, whether that be soaps or jewelry or oils or insurance or photography or tutoring or, you know, whatever your own area of expertise was. And the idea is that that would incubate businesses. And you could buy shares in it. You could contribute by buying shares. And so we bought a couple of shares, Bamboshi and I, and went down one Saturday to see what was happening down there. And the brother that had started this concern talked to us and said, you know, y'all ought to open a store. And I said, no way. This is not what I do. I'm not interested in black capitalism, you know, or any other kind of capitalism. And he said, well, it doesn't have to be capitalistic. And I, you know, again, I'm not interested in owning or running a business. And he said, well, tell me what you like to do. I said, I like to eat and I like to read. You know, I enjoy cooking food that I eat and I like to read. He said, well, open a restaurant. And I said, not happening. That's way too much work. And I've got a job, a career that I enjoy. He said, well, then open a bookstore. Well, I'm going to tell you, when I was a little kid, I used to want to move into public library in my neighborhood. It was just filled with books, and I love books. So Bamboshi and I looked at each other and said, let's open a bookstore. It cost us $25, mind you, which is, you know, less than the cost of a good pizza these days. So we plunked down $25, got in our car and went to a resale store looking for bookshelves, found several of them, loaded them up in the truck and brought them back, and then went through our house. And in our house, there were stacks of books everywhere. Other people use furniture to put their lamps on at the end of their chair or sofa and stuff. We were using stacks of books because every time we ran across one, we would try to bring it home and adopt it like a stray puppy. So between the two of us, we probably had 1,000 books. So we went through those books and we, you know, brought them into the store and put them on the shelves of that, the bookshelves that we had gotten from the thrift store, and the bookstore was born. And it got bigger. And then when Black Wall Street closed down, we said, well, we gave it a good try. But then we found another place that was, you know, 10 times that size and still only cost a few bucks a month. Well, it little issue of a tornado having blown the roof off the place, and it was a dump. But we took a leap of faith and opened up in this bigger space. We had to move around last November, but we found an even better space, and so that's where we are. And so all of that story is to illustrate, I think, for you all, our listeners, the importance of a space that belongs to our community. Now, unfortunately, we don't own that building, which would be a next step for us, because ownership and control of the things that we need to make a life is one of the most important things we can do. But it is a place that is under our control, and it is a place where people in the neighborhood can come and talk about the gentrification of the neighborhood, where people in the neighborhood can come and plan a campaign to resist the Board of Education's decisions to close several of our neighborhood schools. It is a place where people in the neighborhood can come and learn their history, both children and adults. It's a place where children can come and get help with learning how to read. And our elders can come and sip tea and sometimes wine and talk about the books they're reading and whatever else they need to talk about, including their history and how to share it with their children. Interestingly enough, when Brother Africa was reading off important dates for African people on this date. I thought to myself, on this date, about 107 years ago, my grandmother Vivian was born. And for me, that was a day worth marking, because we're talking about the woman who, using both oral history and the power of the written word, taught me so much, taught my siblings and my cousins and the kids next door and her own adult children and anybody else within reach of her voice what needed doing. And I will bet you that each and every one of you, or I would hope that each and every one of you, had likewise a matriarch in your home or a patriarch in your home who told you what you needed to know to make you the man or the woman or the person that you are today. So I feel like I'm coming from a long line of other griots, and that I am doing something, that we are doing something that is just vitally important to the survival of our community, especially in these times when fascism is on the march, when everything in this country and in the world seems to be poised against us, and where when we look beyond ourselves, we see genocide taking place, genocide in Palestine, of course, but also the genocide that's taking part in Sudan and on the Horn of Africa. We see the slower forms of genocide that are taking place when young children as young as 7, 8, 9 years old are poisoning themselves, digging cobalt out of the ground that is necessary to run every cell phone, every computer, every electric car in this part of the world, but is poisoning that part of the world and poisoning them with impunity. They don't get any extra health care. They don't get anything but pennies a day. So there's the kind of genocide that happens when bombs fall on you and soldiers march, and there's the kind of genocide that happens slowly and mostly silently, where what you need to live, in this case, you know, clean earth, clean water, not poisoning yourself by putting your hands on chemicals that leach into your bloodstream and kill you. But the knowledge of those things has to come from someplace. And I'm proud to say that in certain cases, at least to the degree that we are able, that knowledge is coming out of our bookstore. And by the way, we named it Nappy Roots. We're trying to figure out what to name it. And I thought about naming it something like Sankofa. And I thought about naming it something, you know, in any number of things that I could think of that were inspiring and that kind of stuff. But, you know, half the time I'm in a rage. And we decided to name it Nappy Roots because that is a unity statement for African people everywhere. Now, you might dye your hair, you might fry your hair, you might braid your hair, you might lock your hair, you might do any number of other things with your hair. But in the final analysis, all of us have nappy roots. And when we follow those roots back to their origin, back to their origin in the African continent, and gather in all the wisdom that we have caught, that we have touched upon through the diaspora, you know, you can't walk through something, either time or place, without picking up some of the crumbs, picking up some of the wisdom and knowledge and culture and history of those places. You know, even if you're just getting it as dust on your shoes when you're walking, you're picking it up. And so the African diaspora is a powerful thing. Pulling all of those things together and having a place where we can spread that knowledge is so vitally important that we keep doing this bookstore thing, even though it's about to drive me crazy. But, you know, that's just the way life works. So that's how I came to be the owner of a bookstore that basically makes no money and, you know, often makes me cuss, but is a precious, precious space for this community that I live in. So that's kind of my...
Finish your point, Sister. Go ahead.
I'd like to know if anybody had any comments. Has anybody else experienced a bookstore similar to the one to Ellis Books of my childhood, that was a place where the true knowledge of who you are and how to achieve your liberation was shared with you.
We will give people a chance to respond to that in a little while. But at the same time, Sister Camille, when we're talking about African bookstores, I sort of somewhat equated to a continuation of our history of resistance. For example, there used to be a time, and it still exists today, where Europeans created laws where there were two or more Africans on the corner talking to each other. They were coming lock us up. They considered that to be a crime. And I see African bookstores in a similar manner, like you said earlier. It's a place where we have space where we can come together not only to talk about books and acquire books, but also to exchange ideas, to come supportive of each other, and to do the kind of things that we need to do to unite as a people. And there are forces in the society that see that as a threat. One of the issues the African bookstores have faced in the past and they face today is the state see African bookstore as an enemy. Can you talk about maybe some of the perceptions and issues the African bookstores, how they are perceived by the state and may lead to some of their realities not being existing today?
For sure. One of the things about African bookstores is that they, first of all, there are very few of them. There are very few of us doing this in the country, like about 160 some odd African bookstores in this entire huge nation. It is very difficult to do this, to do and to sustain this work. And so there have been direct attacks on some African bookstores. There have been situations where the police have come through the front door looking for an opportunity to bust heads and drag people off to the joint. There have been direct attacks like that, and there have been indirect attacks. We experienced that when we had to move last November, and it turned out that the new owner of the building that we were in, which was just a trashy strip mall, the new owner didn't like what we were doing. He wanted me to do more music events. Now, we do music events. Our music is a really critically important part of our culture, and we actually learn from that music. And, who among us does not know Marvin Gaye's What's Going On and the lesson that he taught on that? Who among us has not listened to the hymns of the civil rights movement and found not only inspiration, but unity and a path forward? So our music is vitally important. But he says, you need to do more music, and you need to, it might be better if you didn't identify as a black bookstore, maybe as a community bookstore, to which I replied something that I don't think I'm allowed to say on the radio, and we had to find another place to to run our bookstore. So there are attacks both directly and indirectly. There have been attacks from the government. There have been the kind of subtle attacks, like you go to the Small Business Association to apply for a loan and they tell you no. You go to the bank to apply for a loan and they tell you no. Okay? So there are those kinds of attacks. You don't have to come at somebody openly, in their face in order to attempt to defeat them. And so as with so many things that we try to do in this nation and elsewhere that would be positive for us, we are led, whether willingly or unwillingly, to do things that are ultimately harmful to our community by those who would oppress us. So right now, I think our number holds at 160 something, but that is a paltry number of institutions that exist to spread and support the words, the knowledge, the history, the thinking of African people, and to be the kind of place where we gather, where we plan, where we learn from each other, where we comfort each other, where we soothe each other, where we encourage each other, and where we do the work that needs to be done. We experienced some direct hassling from the police during what I've come to call the George Floyd era. At one point, we managed to get about 14,000 people in our parking lot and stretching on down the street that the bookstore was on. Brother Africa, you talked about how when two folks would get on the corner and start talking, they called it a crime. Well, when 14,000 people gather on the street and they mad, it causes a great deal of consternation among the powers that be. And they started parking, marked and unmarked cars right outside of our bookstore. And every time one of the people who visited the bookstore or were using the bookstore as an organizing location pulled out onto the street, the cop would pull them over. And that went on until we contacted the law firm out of New York City. I've forgotten what their name is. And they filed a suit against the city. And so they backed off from that a little bit because it was fixing to cost them a lot of money. There's all sorts of hassle that goes on. One of the people that they picked on a whole lot, we had a brother who was a school principal here in town and who had been heading up our youth organization. And they picked on him to the point that he was told that if he got another ticket, that it had come to the attention of the Board of Education that he was getting tickets, a lot of tickets for driving for this thing and that. And they asked, what, are you an alcoholic? Are you a drug addict? Why do you keep getting all these tickets? They knew doggone good and well why he was getting these tickets. But, they were threatening his livelihood, his career, not to mention, the number of people. We talk about George Floyd, but let's remember, some of the hundreds, even thousands of others, tens of thousands of others who've been stopped for a bad headlight or a bad taillight or something like that, and we're never seen or heard from again. Sandra Bland comes to mind, So your life can end because of a traffic stop, and it doesn't matter, who you are or what you were doing. So, yeah, people come at black bookstores in a lot of ways, and we are few and far between, and there needs to be 1,000 more.
At this point in time, you listen to Africa on the Move. He's speaking to our sister Camille. She's one of the co-owners of a bookstore, Nappy Bookstore in Oklahoma. We're talking about the value and the history of African bookstore. Our theme tonight is, what time is it? Is it more time to have more bookstores, African bookstore? And more importantly, is it time to protect the ones we have? We'll continue this discussion when we take our revolutionary culture break, and we invite you, the listening audience, to call in at 323-679-0841. We'll be right back with Sister Camille, Napa Roots Bookstore, and we'd like to have your comments and questions when we return.
Havana, oh no. mountain. Fresh at the end. Pull like a traffic jam. Yeah. I was quick to pay that girl like, damn.
Here you go, ayy. Take it on me. Ayy. Y'all craving on me. Get the beating on me. On me. She waited on me. Damn. Y'all the caking on me. Got the bacon on me.
This is history and I'm making on me.
On me.
Point blank, close range, that's me.
If you're
going to million, that's me.
Me.
I was getting moolah, baby.
Havana, ooh, nah, nah.
Hey.
Half of my heart.
That's right. We are children of Africa. And we too love Havana and love Cuba. We'd just like to acknowledge that there has been a massive blackout in Cuba. And the Cuban people are doing an excellent job of restoring it. It's really interesting how the whole country had a blackout at one time. We know the struggle comes in different forms, and the outer war comes in different forms. We said to our brothers and sisters in Cuba, continue to move forward. We are with you. And those of conscious, you need to join the fight to help end this racist, illegal U.S. blockade against Cuba. Don't believe the hype that you hear. So anyway, brother, to our brothers and sisters in Cuba, we are in solidarity with you, and we love Africa and we love Cuba too. Now let's get back to the discussion today. Our theme is, what time is it? We have with our sister Camille, who is the co-owner of Nappy Moose Bookstore, and we're just talking about and reminding people about the value and importance of African bookstores. You know, African bookstores and what they're going through today and what they are going through in the past. When we talk about the importance of space, it reminds me of Cuba in terms of when you have large gatherings of African people around. For some reason or another, the enemy said we cannot live in peace or will not live in peace. They want to dominate our space at all costs. And we got to do something about that. We got to start getting on down so that people can get on up. Can you dig that? So, Sister Camille, at this point in time, I'm coming back to you, but what we're going to do is we're going to open up our lines to those who may have a comment or question as relates to your bookstore and the concept of the importance of African bookstores at this point in time. So we can go to our first caller, Brother Haki, who is a political organizer for the All African, political organizer for the African Wellness Association, and she's also a panelist on this program. Brother Haki, we can come to you. Any comments or thoughts on the importance of the African bookstore and any questions you'd like to direct toward our sister Camille and her bookstore?
Yeah, well, African bookstores, African bookstores are indispensable in terms of leading the way in terms of the aspirations of our people. Well, one of the things very, very clear, our adversaries don't want us to have access to information. And as such, when you talk about these African bookstores in the neighborhood, they're a valuable asset because in order for us to think, then we have to read. So we need those books in the neighborhood. In fact, the system refers to the bookstores as institutions, and that's precisely what they are. And because it's a vital institution, and without an institution, it complicates our ability in terms of navigating the very difficult situation we find ourselves confronted with in this society. But my question to the sister is this. You know, given the importance in terms of African bookstores, you know, one of the things that, you know, I think we have to find some kind of way in terms of better communicating that message to the community in terms of necessity of bookstores. Because on some level, I don't think a lot of our people get it that the bookstores are essential in terms of our survival. They see it sort of disconnected. So what do we do in terms of bridging that gap in terms of fundamentally understanding that these bookstores, these African bookstores in the community, are part and parcel vital to our survival in society? What can we do?
That is a very good question, but I think the answer to that question lies in the same place that the answer to a question of what can we do about the education system that's failing our children, what can we do about the housing crisis that our communities find themselves in, what can we do about the fact that so many of our communities are food deserts, what can we do about the fact that our political leadership often finds itself working to the detriment rather than to the success of our communities. What can we do about the fact that we have the highest maternal mortality rate, one of the highest maternal mortality rates for Black women of any place in the world, that a Black woman with a doctorate degree and excellent health care is still more likely to die in childbirth than a white woman with a sixth grade education who lives in terrible poverty. because of the racist structure of our healthcare system. You know, so the answer to all of those questions and questions of that sort is the same. It's kind of a shorthand to say this, but I would say the answer to it, the solution to it, is Black power. I was listening to our brother Mukasa Ricks, whom I know you all have heard from yesterday, and he was talking about it. And so Black power is a lot more than marching down the street and waving your fists in the air and shouting, although, you know, that kind of activism is also necessary many times. But true Black power is the ability of communities to both meet their own needs and to demand equity and in our relationships with governing, you know, with governance. So that means if we're not getting the appropriate amount of support from a governmental entity for our health and welfare, for our well-being, then we have to demand it, and it takes power to put any kind of emphasis behind that demand so that it is, you know, so that it happens. But we have to look at the structures because, you know, you all know that racism is systemic, and racism is not an individual thing. I don't give a hoot what somebody thinks about me personally. I give a whole lot of hoots about how that person, when they go to work, helps establish institutions and structures that mean that that living in my neighborhood is living amongst poison. You know, that when I turn on the tap, poison water might come out, as it does for not only the people in Flint, Michigan, but the people in many, many, many other places across the country, including where I live right now. You know, because the pipes in my neighborhood are old, and they're older than the pipes in certain other neighborhoods, and what comes out of my pipes is often, you know, just borderline fit to drink. Black power is the answer to that. We need to come together to demand what we need from the political power structure, but more importantly, we need to form our own structures that meet needs, and that requires work, and that requires unity.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, sister, is that, you know, when we talk about reading, that the old term of saying that reading is fundamental, and so the points that you raise in terms of systemic inequalities that our people confront with are very, very real. But because of reading is so fundamental, it's what can we do in terms of crafting a message in a way that's not particularly intricate, but right down to the point in terms of importance in terms of reading, because reading has to be the catalyst in terms of understanding the broader world. And so therefore, it seems to me that, you know, that if we can get people to support African bookstores, then certainly we empower that process, or we enable that process to move forward in terms of understanding much broader complexities in terms of the situation we're confronted with. So what I'm getting at, I'm just wondering, what can we do in terms of focusing solely on this question in terms of reading? Now, and what can we, in terms of education, understand we can tie reading into successfully, you know, being educated, and certainly we can make that connection. In terms of reading, in terms of the more more intricate elements of the society, what kind of message can we craft simplistically that get people to understand in terms of reading has to be priority? What can we do?
That's a far more complex question, and the solution is far more complex than one would think at first glance. The number one reason and the number one predictor of poor reading skills is not even the quality of education. It is the quality of life that the young children that you're talking about and their families live. That is the best predictor of whether or not that child will be able to live. Does that child have adequate housing? Does that child have adequate food? Does that child have adequate time with caring adults? Does that child have safety when she or he walks down the street? Safety not only from, you know, from somebody wishing to cause harm to her or him or them, but also safety in terms of, you know, not being poisoned, you know, by you know, lead or lead paint or lead in the water pipes. Those things are the number one predictor of success in school. So even when you are pouring massive resources into an area, into the school area, and very few places do, but even when they try, they find out that it does not always work. But do you know what does work? Some years ago, my children at the time were too young to attend this school before it was destroyed by the state, but there was a charter school here, and on the whole, I hate charter schools. They seem to they do exist to take resources from public education, which benefits everybody in this country, and that is or should be a crime. But at any rate, they're big news in a lot of places, and so people in my community formed a charter school called Marcus Garvey school. And at Marcus Garvey, you know, they gathered in the morning to the tune of djembe drums, and they identified themselves as African children, and they knew the story of the Great Learning Center of Timbuktu. And when somebody did something that was particularly intelligent or smart, they were told that they were looking very African. You know how some folks in this country will tell a studious child, you acting like a white boy, your nose in that book. Well, you know, we told them, you acting very African, little brother. You know, you got that book tucked under your arm. And so that school, even though it didn't have the highest of test scores, still produced many, many, many children that, despite the fact that they were in the second poorest zip code of the city, they produced many scholarly individuals who have gone on to become very successful adults. And when I say successful, I'm not talking about six-figure incomes. I'm talking about successful in ways of being a good citizen, a good contributor to their community and to their families. And so it is possible to mold our children in such a way that they do become successful readers. But again, it takes, well, for one thing, you know, there's a reason that, for instance, the Black Panther Party started a Breakfast for Children program. They said you can't make a revolution on an empty stomach, and you can't learn on an empty stomach, you know. So when you have an educational institution, it's necessary for the success of that institution in our community for it to be culturally relevant, and it is also necessary for it to meet the unmet needs, the human needs of the students and, by extension, their family, because it doesn't do any good, you know, to feed a baby when his mom is starving, you know? So that's why it's so complex, because better teachers are not the only answer. You can't teach to somebody with an empty stomach. You can't teach a child who was up all night listening to his mama cry because there had been a situation of domestic violence in the home. You can't teach a child whose daddy is behind bars for doing nothing other than, you know, being black and being in the wrong place. Daddy might be behind bars. Daddy might be 6 feet under, you know. Just depends on the luck of the draw. And you know, that child and that child's parents and family spent, you know, grandmom and everything spent that time crying. You can't teach a child who's been snatched from the arms of their family and thrown into the foster care system and bopped around from place to place to place, none of which treat him like a human being, none of which provide love and security. And then you send that child to school and tell him the most important thing for you to do is to meet the, you know, is to take the standardized test and get a good score or read this book. And one other thing, a lot of people have found, a number of people have found, and this has been studied, when we talk about reading, again, I opened this conversation talking about the griot. You know, the oral history of our community is strong. Each and every one of us has heard stories out of our granddaddies or grandmama's mouths, and much of what we know about how to be a whole and healthy adult came from those stories. And so if you can't get the little brothers and sisters to sit down and open up a book for whatever reasons they're not doing it, then tell them the story, because that is literature just as surely as what has been rendered on a page in ink and paper. So things have to be culturally relevant. I have a group of friends that are indigenous people a few years ago developed their own charter school, which was also, interestingly enough, taken from them. But they said that Native children don't learn by sitting behind, don't learn well by sitting behind desks in a school and reading stories about little blind children. So we want them to sit in a circle on the floor, and we want to talk to them the way their grandmamas talk to them, because you know what people do? They pay attention to what grandmama has to say. And so they changed the way they taught so it was culturally relevant, and their students did a lot better.
All right, Ms. Supu, let's go to our next caller. We're bringing Brother Anthony. He's the organizer for the All African Peoples Revolutionary Party, GC. Any comments or questions you have for Sister Camille as we discuss the importance of African bookstore? What time is it? Brother Anthony, the mic is yours. While we wait for Brother Anthony, let's move on to Brother Moses. Any comments or questions you have for Sister Camille as we discuss this whole issue of the relevancy of African bookstores at this time? Brother Moses.
Thank you, Brother Africa. Greetings, Sister. I think, you know, it's great that you found business opportunities to serve the people and keep politics in command and run a bookstore. I think that's commendable, and certainly we need information. Without information, we can't think. And so, you know, information is knowledge, and that's empowering. And so books offer us indirect knowledge. We get to learn from other people's experiences, so we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We don't have to go through things that have already been gone through. We can learn from other people's experiences. And that's the value of books. That's why books are so important. When we get to writings, there are writings and there are writings. And some writings are such that so shall it be written, so shall it be done. And so, you know, there are some writings are more important than others. I bear witness that Jesus is the author and finisher of my faith, and that for government, Mao Zedong is his messenger. I hope to have the serenity to accept the things I can't change the things I can't accept, and the wisdom to know the difference. And, you know, 2 + 2 = 4, no matter who teaches it to you, whether you learn it from Kwame Ture or Mao Zedong, the most important thing is that you get the science. And socialism is a science and must be pursued as a science. As V.I. Lenin said, it must be studied. Workers study, and turn themselves into communists. And that's why books are so important. And I'll just leave it right there. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Moses. That is very important. Everything that you said is absolutely true. We have a lot to learn from a lot of people. There's a lot of wisdom in our history, whether we're talking about our faith communities or whether we're talking about our political communities. There's a lot of wisdom to be had, and I wish that wisdom was shared more with not only our young people, but excuse me, but in addition to that, to other adults.
Sister Camille, what we're going to do right now, we're going to ask you to just speak to this importance to our audience of the value of bookstores again, and maybe make a few statements on the conditions of our brothers and sisters in Cuba today in terms of the blackout, as well as the ongoing genocide of our brothers and sisters of the Palestinians. Again, you can just close out, and more importantly, we want to know how can we support your bookstore? What can be done? So we're going to just open up the mic and take as much time as you want to articulate the request that we just asked from you.
Okay, well, supporting my bookstore and the bookstores in your community, if you're fortunate enough to have one, involves doing a couple things. It involves buying books, first and foremost. And if you can't buy a book or don't want to buy a book for whatever reason, you know, just go by there and drop $5 in their donation box. I guarantee you they have a donation box, because I can also guarantee you that one thing you are not going to get from running a bookstore is welfare. It's touch and go, even for white-owned bookstores. It's not just me and other black bookstores like mine. So that is part of the success. And using those bookstores for other purposes, using those bookstores to have meetings and conversations in your community and that kind of thing are another way in which you can use the bookstore, because the more traffic that you have coming through that bookstore, the more likely it is that they will, first of all, be able to sell merchandise, which is important, but even more important is that they have an impact upon the community. A lot of bookstores actually go after grant money and that kind of thing to keep themselves alive. So that is one of the things that you can do. In general, again, this comes down to if we have our own structures, our own institutions, then those institutions are relevant to our needs. They are answering our needs. I had a conversation with the Ministerial Association in my city. There are like two churches on every block in many places in Oklahoma City, and we're not alone in that regard. And I said to the preachers, I said, you know, every Sunday morning, you all accept, you know, easily $1 million, sometimes multi-$1 million that comes out of the pockets of the people in your pews. You know, this is a lot of money. And then this money is in your control, you know, on Sunday morning, and by Tuesday morning, or really by Monday morning, that money has gone from this community. That money is in the hands of Chase Bank or Bank of America or PNC Bank or you name your bank, but it is not in the black community. And so that money is going to make another community healthy and wealthy and whole. It is not going to fund small businesses in your community. It is not going to build houses in your community. It's not even going to build a doggone donut shop to make your community fat with high cholesterol. It's left your community as soon as the banks open on Monday morning. And so we have to look at what we do with the resources that we own. Why don't we take the money that these preachers collect, that, you know, in their churches every Sunday morning, and invest it in a small bank or credit union, you know, that would give a loan to a bookstore or to my next door neighbor, a single mother who's saving up to buy a home. You know, and so that's one of the things that we have to do is it is important to support whatever institutions do exist in our community and to be mindful about what we do with our money. African people in the United States, we certainly have far less wealth than white people do, but we aren't without wealth. And what we do with that wealth needs to be mindful, and it needs to answer the needs of our community collectively, not just individuals. If you are in the business of a black bookstore or any other kind of black store, and your only goal is to, you know, be able to buy a new Lexus next year, you're not doing your community any good. You know, you can get the car you want, but you also need to figure out how you fit, what puzzle piece you are in this puzzle of survival and thriving in our own community, because none of us are free unless all of us are free.
And Camille, for those who may want to contribute to Nappy Bookstore, who may not live in Oklahoma City, how do they reach out? How do they make their generous contribution to your bookstore?
Okay. Right now, this is another whole story, Brother Africa. The people who provide fiscal sponsorship to my bookstore and under whose umbrella we become a nonprofit institution have been attacked in a very ugly way by right-wing Zionists, and we call it deplatforming. They've dropped a dime, so to speak, and said, you know, these people are engaged in questionable activities that are anti-Semitic and pro-Palestinian, and they're very distasteful, and you should not let them use your. It's called a merchant processing bank. It is a bank that handles credit card transactions. Like if you slide your card, whether it's at the gas pump or at a store or whatever, you slide or tap your card. These merchant processing banks are the ones that note that transaction and get the money out of your bank where it's on deposit, and then send it to the place where you bought gas or groceries or whatever it is that you're buying. We have been, my fiscal sponsor, Alliance for Global Justice, has been deplatformed so that we can't use any of those mechanisms, either for my support, the support of my bookstore, or the support of the 140 other projects that they support, or the support of the organization itself. That's a form of internal sanctions. We wonder why Cuba had a blackout? Because of sanctions. And those same sanctions are attacking me and us. So the best way to support us, write a check to Nappy Roots Books. Send it to 3621 North Lottie Avenue, Lottie, Oklahoma City, 73111. Send me $5. Send me $10. Send me what you can afford, and we will put it to work, making sure that at least some of our children learn how to read. We will put it to work, making sure that there is a place where Big Mama can come and sip tea and talk about Black history, and where the brothers in the community can come and learn about personal health and the other things that we do in our community can be supported. That's Nappy Roots Books at 3621 North Lottie, Oklahoma City, OK, 73111. And you can ask Brother Africa. He knows my address.
Okay, my sister, we'd like to thank you for sharing your time with us as it relates to the importance of the African Bookstore, and particularly the current status of Nappy Roots Bookstore. And let's stay in touch and continue to discover down the road of liberation. We thank you very much for your contributions to today's program.
Thank you very much, Brother Africa, and all your listeners for your support of Black knowledge, Black brilliance, and Black liberation.
All right. That was Sister Camille from Nappy Roots Bookstore in Oklahoma City. We're going to take a revolutionary culture break, and when we come back, we have political panelists and analysts. They're going to share with us what's going on in our world, and we will continue to proceed towards addressing the theme today, which is the first part of a two-part series, What Time Is It? We'll be right back. I'm Brother Africa, and you are listening to Africa on the Move.
He is my king. He is my one. Yes, he's my father. Yes, he's my son. I can talk to him because he understands everything I go through and everything I am. My support system, I can't live without him. The best thing since sliced bread is his kiss, his hugs, his lips, his touch. Not just want the whole world to know about my
black brother. I love you and I'll never try to hurt you. I want you to know that I'm here for you forever too. Cause you're my black brother, strong brother, and there is no one above you.
Well, for your information, a lot of my brothers got education. Now check it, you got your Wall Street brother, your blue collar brother, you're down for whatever, chilling on the corner brother, your talented brother, and to every one of y'all behind bars, you know that Angie loves you, of my
black brother.
Thinking towards your space.
That's right. If you had a rocket launcher, what would you do with it today? Welcome back to Africa on the Move. You listen to Brother Africa, and like always, we're in the seat. We're going to take the heat as you define it. We're going to stand behind it. We may not give you what you want, but we damn sure do the best to give you what you need. We know in order to get on down, we must, that way we help our people get on up. So let's get on down and continue so our people can get on up. Welcome back to Africa on the Move, and we'd like to shout out to our Kenya family, our brothers and sisters in Kenya, who have been giving us much love and much support. We'd like to thank you. And to our number one fan in Canada, Sister Yvette, we'd like to thank you for all the love that you have been sharing with Africa on the Move. Keep it coming. Keep it coming. Keep us strong so we can continue to fight the fight. So welcome back to Africa on the Move, Part 1. What time is it? Right now, we're going to bring our political panelists and analysts in at this point in time. We'd like to briefly introduce themselves and tell us what's going on in our world community. Brother Haki, we're going to bring you in right now. You can use the time to briefly introduce yourself, and you also have a message for our people. So this is your time. Go and kick some ballistics, Brother Haki.
Yes, my name is Haki Kamati Mashoki. Currently, I'm with African Awareness, and I've been doing this for close to 35, 40 years in terms of the liberation of our people. One of the things, you know, I'm going to do, Brother Africa, I'm going to defer from any type of commentary at this point because we've got a lot to cover in a very short period of time. But I briefly want to talk about the instability of the U.S. economy. And one reason why I talk about instability is because it's key in terms of understanding instability impacts the lives of people living residing inside the United States. But one of the things we talk about instability in the U.S. economy, keep in mind, whenever that instability manifests itself, the U.S. has allies. It has a European continent, which if reverse means prop up the U.S. economy in showing that the economy doesn't collapse. The problem is that even though they're attempting to prop up the U.S. economy, the bottom line is that their efforts are simply not as effective as they were 10, 20 years ago. But in any event, to give you some idea in terms of, you know, this whole question around propping up the U.S. economy, I think first and foremost, people should understand that recently the big banks invested $2.4 trillion in hedge funds and private equity. Now, hedge funds and private equity, for people who don't know, those institutions are primarily all about buying up assets and keep increasing their prices in order for profits. So we talk about, you know, these institutions, hedge funds and private equity, you're buying houses, buying property. They buy these assets and they raise the prices in order to increase profitability. And in the course of doing that, they undermine the U.S. economy. But it doesn't matter because it's a capitalist society. It's not really about the economy per se. It's all about the economy as it exists on paper. In other words, as long as the wealthy prosper, then everything is fine. It doesn't really pertain to the real economy. In terms of, you know, jobs, goods, and services, those kind of things that people depend on for the survival in society. Now, having said that, Brother Africa, when we talk about the central bank's desire to prop up the U.S. economy, they too have been buying stocks and investing in hedge funds and private equity. And then the question becomes, obviously, but why would these European central banks, why would they, aside from helping the U.S. economy, take a risk in terms of propping up U.S. economy? Well, essentially, there are two reasons why it's a necessity in terms of them to prop up the U.S. economy. One is that the U.S. stock decline, both in value and volume of stocks, so has been negatively impacted. In other words, the value of the number of stocks actually produced have actually been decreasing, and for good reason, because the U.S. economy is in decline. And also, you know, one of the things that you know, when you talk about in terms of this decline of the U.S. economy, we have to keep in mind that much of it has to do with changes taking place throughout the world. In particular, when we talk about, you know, investment opportunities elsewhere, we got to realize with the emergence of the BRICS nations, the Middle East nations, U.S. stocks have become less desirable. Now, this lack of desirability of U.S. stocks exists for two reasons primarily. One, economic instability. In other words, the level of debt increases in the U.S., unemployment and low wages complicates the ability of the U.S. to pay its debts. And also, secondly, indebtedness of U.S. corporations, which negatively impact the price of stocks. Now, so in other words, so when we talk about the U.S. corporations, for instance, actually, you know, producing everything abroad and paying people pennies on the dollar, and essentially what we're saying is that they're bankrupting the U.S. economy. And of course, it's very powerful for them to pay people peanuts to make, you know, to make profits, or to invest in prison, you know, to make profit. But the bottom line, it does negatively impact the U.S. economy. As a consequence of impacting the U.S. economy, in terms of being able to pay off your investors, U.S. simply is hard pressed to come up with those funds to pay the investors. And so, even though the European nation central banks are attempting to assist the U.S. in terms of preventing its fall, the bottom line is when we talk about $36 trillion in debt, the bottom line is that they cannot recover from that. So it's important that people understand the fundamental nature in terms of this depreciation of the U.S. economy. I think one of the things that when we talk about the decline of the economy, we've got to understand fundamentally, as an oppressed people, then we understand that as this economy deconstructs, as it declines, then we have to fundamentally understand that someone has to be blamed for that. That's very important that the masses of our people understand someone must be blamed for that. Of course, the people who are responsible for this decline in the U.S. economy are not going to take the blame. They're going to blame everybody else. They're going to blame African people. They're going to blame Latin people. They're going to blame immigrants. They blame gays. They blame women. They blame everybody but themselves. So keep in mind, so we talk about this economic decline that's taking place in society. And let's be very, very clear, you know, that as it relates to our longevity in society, our longevity becomes questionable. In other words, we got to understand that the historical flow of history, which has been very, very negative, very, very destructive, also has potential to impact the U.S. economy. And because that is a reality, then we got to understand that we got to be forthright and understand that whatever in everything that comes down the road, we got to be prepared for. That is just a sad reality. So whether or not we think that it's in our interest of knowing, we got to think again, because the whole point is that we have to fundamentally understand these changes that are sweeping the nation. And so when we see the rise of someone like Donald Trump, and we see the rise of racism in the society, we see the rise of the decimation of educational material or education itself in the society, then we understand there's implications behind that. And the implication is very, very clear, that these people in positions of power are doing all and anything they can in terms of maintaining power and control. That power and control is slipping away, which means that they must find some scapegoats in terms of taking the blame for as things decline and fall. So having said that, Brother Africa, I conclude.
Thank you, Brother Haki. At this point in time, going to Brother Moses. Briefly introduce yourself and tell us what's going on in your world community. 2 to 3 minutes, Brother Moses. The mic is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Brother Africa, and greetings to Brother Haki. And it's great to be here. My name is Robert Andrew Moses. I've been in the struggle for scientific socialism from the moment I was introduced to Karl Marx during a government class back in my high school years, 1968. I call Marxism the race to cure racism. I bear witness that Jesus is the author and finisher of my faith, and that Mao Zedong is his messenger for government. Fathers, help your children. We don't reverse correct verdicts. I'm pro-choice, and I vote. I bear witness that women hold up half the sky, therefore I'm for the Equal Rights Amendment, ERA, yes. And the struggle is to continue on all three fronts, the economic struggle, the political, and the theoretical struggle. We must adhere to revolutionary theory that is concrete analysis of concrete conditions that points to the path of liberation for our people. This is the quest. You know, we're in a class struggle with 1% of the population controlling the wealth of the society, and that we must use politics, the state, the government, to redistribute wealth. And anything short of that, anything short of revolution is just rhetoric. And so I'll leave it right there. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Moses. We're going to our Sister Eleanor. Sister Eleanor, briefly introduce yourself and 2 to 3 minutes. Tell us what's going on in your world.
My name is Eleanor Johnson. Good evening to you, Brother Africa, Sister Camille, fellow analysts, and to our listening audience in the United States and abroad. I'm Eleanor Johnson. I'm an environmentalist and a social, a human rights advocate. This is a wonderful weekend. Tomorrow, October 21st, will be the birthday of Marcus Garvey. It'll be the celebration, a national holiday in Jamaica, of the birth of Marcus Garvey. It's a national holiday there. So there's a lot of good things going up in Cuba as well. Carmen, so much for a wonderful educational conversation on the importance of bookstores focusing on our history, especially as you see 1610 and so many other, so much other Black literature being attacked. Thank you.
Thank you, Sister Eleanor. As you know, earlier today, we sent out an agenda. There were several issues and topics we wanted to address on this program. Unfortunately, we'll address only one today and do the remainder next week on part two. What I'm going to do right now is play a clipping on Africa is just a cemetery for Africans. How can it be developed? The statement was made by Vladimir Putin, who's the president of Russia. And when you listen to the statement, is it the messenger that makes the reality so harsh, or is the reality itself that makes the statement so harsh? And how can we, again, address that question? Again, the title of this particular tripping is Africa is a Cemetery for Africans. How can it be developed? And let's just speak to some of the contradictions that has been laid out in this particular narrative. Let's play it.
Vladimir Putin says Africa is a cemetery for Africans. When an African becomes rich, his bank accounts are in Switzerland. He travels to France for medical treatment. He invests in Germany. He buys from Dubai. He consumes Chinese. He prays in Rome or Mecca. His children study in Europe. He travels to Canada, USA, and Europe for tourism. If he dies, he will be buried in his native country. Africa is just a cemetery for Africans. How could a cemetery be developed? Vladimir Putin says, Africa is a cemetery for Africans. When an African becomes rich, his bank accounts are in Switzerland. He travels to France for medical treatment. He invests in Germany. He buys from Dubai. He consumes Chinese. He prays in Rome or Mecca. His children study in Europe. He travels to Canada, USA, and Europe for tourism. If he dies, he will be buried in his native country. Africa is just a cemetery for Africans. How could a cemetery be developed? Vladimir Putin says, Africa is a cemetery for Africans. When an African becomes rich, his bank accounts are in Switzerland. He travels to France for medical treatment. He invests in Germany. He buys from Dubai. He consumes Chinese. He prays in Rome or Mecca. His children study in Europe. He travels to Canada, USA, and Europe for tourism. If he dies, he will be buried in his native country. Africa is just a cemetery for Africans.
You heard a statement, panelists and analysts. As you critique it, what will be your response to this particular statement? And is this a reality at this particular time when we look at some of the conditions that are taking place in Africa and the African community abroad? Your response to the critique, Brother Haki.
Well, Brother Africa, you know, it was expressed somewhat harshly, but I think nonetheless the tenets of what he was saying was absolutely correct.
we can't dismiss the level of corruption among African leaders. I mean, that is part and parcel of the reason why Africa's in a particular position. There's corruption. This notion in terms of, you know, prospering at the expense of their people is very much a model which is embraced by many African leaders. And it's just hard to argue with that. One of the things, we got a large continent of 54 states, and currently we only got three that are actually resisting neoliberal or neo-colonial policies. The rest are actually working in concert with the West in terms of continuation of the underdevelopment of Africa, or certainly the marginalization of Africa. So how do we explain that? And I think the only thing we can explain that is that we have to fundamentally understand that the psychological dimension of our oppression is very, very real. It's not that we don't have the capabilities or the material possessions in terms of changing the condition that we're confronted with. The problem is that psychologically, we are dependent. We got the psychological disposition which says that, you know, we have to play along with the West because it's the best game in town, not understanding that the real power that the West wields actually comes from you. So the mere fact that you're willing to give up your power to the West for you know, the trinkets, so it speaks volumes in terms of the level of the mental conditioning that impacting a lot of African leaders. And as much as I would like to say that colonialism or certainly materialism plays a big part in terms of the motivation of corrupt African leaders, but it's more than just a materialism that's driving these African leaders. To a large extent, we can't underscore enough the problem in terms of the psychological disposition that exists in the mind of African people who equate themselves in terms of their sophistication with the West, only because they don't understand African history. And so therefore they tend to believe that whatever the West does is sophisticated and good and proper, and they should emulate that. That to me suggests a kind of nefarious kind of thinking, a very negative, counterproductive kind of thinking, which encompasses so a lot of African leaders. So I think until that mindset is destroyed or eliminated, I think one thing that's a strong tendency of many African leaders to continue to persist in playing ball with the West. One final thing, let me conclude with this. One of the things that we got to be very, very clear on, we talk about in terms of resources. And for these corrupt African leaders, they always tell you, well, if we buck the trend and we go against the West's interest, they're going to simply undermine us in terms of undermining our economy. Well, the whole point is that, you know what, with the change of the world of governmental structure, there are other places in which African leaders can go to for investment. And here's the thing. Without African resources, the West would simply go back to the Stone Ages in which it arrived. And so the whole point is that Africa wields real power and not even realize that. And so when you're threatened by the West in terms of the potential, in terms of taking away your money or blocking your economy, you tell them, go ahead and do that, because there are many, many people you can trade with. There are many, many people who are willing to exchange technology, many, many people who are willing to educate your students, so you don't need the West. But so the oppression is not a material one, as the brother talked about. The oppression is a psychological one. It's the same psychological oppression that impacts Africans born in the U.S., because we have, as the sister alluded to earlier, we have the resources to fundamentally change our condition. We just don't have the mindset to do so. So there's a kind of psychological oppression which sort of negate us from actually doing what we can do in terms of empowering ourselves. So clearly, Brother Africa, so what Putin was essentially saying, harsh, but nonetheless true, and I conclude.
Okay, let's go to our next political panelist, analyst, Brother Moses. Your critique from this, what are your statements that you just heard, Brother Moses?
Yeah, obviously he's talking about the corrupt board-off sector of African leadership. He's accurate in describing what's going on. We need people in power who are willing to serve the people and look out for the vast majority of the people's interests and not just their own interests. And this to getting those people in power is easier said than done. We have to prove our leadership in words and deeds and convince people of the truthness of our path. And once everybody's convinced of the truth of our path is on that path, we can accomplish something. I mean, I'm reminded of Bob Marley, Exodus, Movement of Jah People. We know where we're coming from. We know where we're going. We know where we've been, Movement of Jah People. And so we are faced with capitalism, unbridled finance capital, tyranny of finance capital manifests itself into fascism, which is the open tyranny of capitalism and finance capital. And that's what we're faced with. The Palestinian people are starving, are being annihilated. And the sounds of our friends, as Dr. Martin Luther King said, in the end, we won't remember the words of our enemies, but the sounds of our friends. And what's the word? Word is not no longer Johannesburg. The word is Palestine. Freedom ain't nothing but a word. And so, I don't know. I'm just venting tonight. I'm sorry. I'm buckshotting around. I'll leave it right there. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Moses. And Sister Eleanor, your critique of the statement, the mic is yours.
The statement is really true. And what's interesting is that the people have been brainwashed into thinking that, and it is an affluence that many Africans in America or born in America do not experience. But living in Belgium and the greatest economy in Europe, which is Great Britain, is greater than all the other European countries. And having that type of affluence and determining whether your children go to school in France, United States, or even Germany is a privilege many don't. And the saving money in Swiss bank accounts and this kind of thing, and then having the 2-week celebration to go home to be buried has turned Africa into a living cemetery. And it's very harsh for the it to have to be told in such a candid way, but it's true. And we're going to have to reassess as Pan-Africanists on the eve of Marcus Garvey's birthday how we're going to live as a people. Thank you.
Thank you, Sister Eleanor. To all my panelists, I want y'all just briefly respond to the statement. As you listen to that statement, it seems to also describe the essence of being a neo-colonialist. And what about the African leadership in the African diaspora? Do they also express the same characteristics and do the same thing? Are they also not to be lumped in that reality, Brother Haki?
Well, yeah, that's the point I originally made. Exactly right. So we talk about the manifestation of behaviors or ideas or thoughts that are reminiscent of, you know, of the colonial power structure. Of course, the same kind of very negative perceptions that African leaders hold in terms of their ability or their sense of powerlessness is also manifest in terms of African people in America. The question in terms of when we talk about resources in America or wealth in North America, African people control close to $3 trillion in terms of GDP. Now, when we talk about $3 trillion, of course, we understand in the final analysis, it's a lot of assets that we own in terms of wealth. But just in terms of hardcore dollars, if in fact we were to convert those assets into dollars, there's much that we can do in terms of remedying the situation we're confronted with. The problem is not one of wealth. The problem is one of will. In other words, we have this colonial mentality in which we say that we brought hook, line, and sinker to this notion that, in fact, that we are, in fact, inferior. So we resist any idea in terms of self-empowerment because we don't think we're capable of doing it. Of course, we don't come out and say that, I feel like I'm inferior. We don't say that. But it's very clear in terms of your behavior. So when you don't gravitate toward liberation, if you don't struggle for liberation, if you indeed refuse to even acknowledge liberation as an option, it suggests that aside from the terms of monetary motivation, it suggests that the psychological dimension plays a bigger role in terms of your unwillingness, in terms of fighting the system, which fundamentally at odds in terms of African people's existence. And let me just clear us up on that point. I think it's important we understand this. One of the things, when we talk about materialism being the quintessential point in terms of the motivation for human beings, what we essentially do is we negate in terms of the consciousness of human beings. In other words, we ascribe to the fact or the notion that whenever people do something, there's always a material motivation behind it. Well, if you stop and think about it, when you look at the condition of African people in the society, in American society, disproportionately, when you look at the kind of poverty and mayhem and chaos and discontent, when you look at that level of subjugation, as a person in the African community, and to look at that, understanding that at some point, those conditions will adversely impact your children. So to argue that, in fact, economically, it's in your interest to carry out the norms and traditions of the system, to do so is to negate the fact, you know, that you yourself, at some point, your family members particularly, are going to suffer as a result of those very same conditions that you legitimize, that you simply accept. So the motivation is not material. The motivation is psychological. We believe that money defines us as a human being. We think that the more money we have, the more somebody we are. So we're unwilling in terms of sharing resources because we think that, well, if I give up resources, give up a few dollars, that's like giving up a part of me. And so that is quintessential of thinking of terms of, you know, in terms of the capitalist mindset, which sort of makes it in terms of navigating a way out. Because if you think that your existence is determined by material things, then of course what you do is you play ball with the system. This is the problem. It's not the material deprivation that's potentially a problem. It's a psychological deprivation which is the problem. So this is the thing that we have to fundamentally understand. So when people start talking about the issue of class, I should smile because I know human beings are much more complex than to say that everybody's motivated by money. In fact, if we're motivated by money, historically there will be no revolutionaries. Historically, there will be no movement in terms of African people willing to free themselves. They were simply give in to this notion in terms of access to money, but people don't. So people operate on a higher consciousness. So to simply say that people only exist to the extent people's existence only is viable to the extent that people have access to money is a very foolish concept, a very foolish idea to internalize. To the extent we internalize that, we play by rules of the game. We legitimize the capitalist system. We think it's the greatest thing in the world, even though it's killing us. And I conclude.
And Brother Moses, is this also a reflection in the African bourgeoisie? They also act the same way based upon this audio clipping that we just listened to? Your response, Brother Moses.
Do they act the same way? What did you say?
Don't the African bourgeoisie, the petty bourgeoisie, inside and outside of Africa, fit the description that described in this audio?
I'm not willing to go so far beyond the upper echelon of the Compadre class, those who sold out African leadership. I don't know that the masses of people, the lower classes are so sold out as such. I'm not convinced of that. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just not in touch enough. But
the upper elite class, Brother Moses.
Yeah, the upper elite class is definitely, he described them accurately, no question about that. But the petty bourgeoisie is not the upper elite per se. It's part of the 99% ultimately. You have to really be making some money. The problem with class society is institutionalized. That's why classes are possible, because the institutionalized systems that are fundamental to society. And so, you know, to eliminate class society is to eliminate those institutions. And, you know, so it's not so much about whether people are personally motivated by money per se. They're just motivated to food, clothing, and shelter, and whatever interest they have. And so in the pursuit of all these different phenomena throughout society, we come to class consciousness about the strata of society and how it's divided up and who's who and what's what. And so, you know, there's only a small percentage of the population that controls the wealth. And so we have to understand that and recognize that, you know, the vast majority of us have a friendship. We should be friends. There shouldn't be any animosity between us. We're spiritual people in a material world. That's the key thing. We're spiritual people in a material world. And, you know, and if I may plug it now, that's why prayer is so important, because we are spiritual people in a material world. And I'll leave it right there. Thank you.
Exactly. We make the corrections, Sister Aladora. We're talking about the black bourgeoisie, the so-called African leadership class that many people define today inside U.S. and throughout the diaspora. Do they exhibit the same characteristics that were stated in this audio clipping that we just listened to? Your response.
Yes,
Sister Eleanor.
I'm sorry, Brother Africa, I didn't hear you. Would you repeat the question?
He described the tendencies of Africans in leadership, how they conduct themselves and behave themselves, and how they see Africa in the sense as a cemetery, where they spend resources for everything outside. They mimic everything that the person does. Doesn't this characteristic reflect the same thing of the so-called black misleadership class inside the United States and throughout?
Well, that's true. It's a strange, phenomenal thing. But neocolonialism has allowed the brothers and sisters on the continent to sell out the nation. And it is a shame, as Brother Aki said, that only Burkina Faso, Mali, and one other nation are standing up against the Europeans and trying to get rid of the African franc and to reassess their money, and realizing that the value of the cobalt, the diamonds, the other things we need, especially cobalt and things like this for our cell phones, it's up to us to determine the value of that. And as for the United States, you see the very rich Africans born here with horse farms and wineries and this and that, and you do not see them interfacing in the community. I'm sure they contribute socially, but they're like the Jeff Bezos of the African community. They do not pay any attention to our needs or concerns. What is that? And, you know, there's a problem with respect. For example, right now I'm in the hospital and I was able to sit here all day in potty waste, vomit, and filth. And now I'm trying to speak for a few moments on Africa on the Move and Sibley Memorial Hospital, owned by the Johns Hopkins University, has changed so drastically. It's ridiculous. It's not the workers, but it's just a part of being a member of the petty bourgeoisie and emulating the behavior.
Thank you, Sister Eleanor. Mm-hmm. At this point in time, we're going to take a break. When we return, we're going to close out the program with our political panelists and analysts giving us their final thoughts. And of course, we make a few announcements, and we'll continue to travel down the road of liberation. This is Brother Africa, and you are listening to Africa on the Move.
before the shit start, before it get dark, before they hit you with the pitchfork. Better crip walk, this is real talk. Smoke push, ambush, then we peel off. Niggas still rolling with the wheels off. Always looking out for the crisscross. I'm a bigger boss than Rick Ross. Always winning, nigga get lost. It's the warlord, bring the voodoo. When I bail through, it's crazy like Bellevue. What they tell you, leave that boy alone. Like Home Alone, yeah. Fuck a skull and bone. Arrest the president, you got the evidence. That nigga is Russian intelligence. When it rains, it pours. Did you know the new white was orange? Boy, you're showing your horns. They trying to replace my halo with thorns. You so basic with your vape sticks. Let's go ape shit in the matrix. Arrest the president, arrest the president, arrest the president. You got the evidence. Arrest the president, arrest the president, arrest the president. You got the evidence. I took back my ice and all black tonight. That's right, some niggas gotta sacrifice. Not a criminal, no, I'm a seminal, yeah. I was free once, now I'm clinical. You so technical, this was Mexico. Now everywhere I go is owned by Texaco.
Fuck them
and the rest
Hell
of you,
yeah.
I turn a fruit into a backstop. I'ma roll with the aliens. Man, fuck these homo sapiens. They don't really wanna make friends. All they want is a Mercedes Benz. All they want is they dividends and decibels. Fuck these citizens. They'll treat us like hooligans. Throw him in, they don't care what school he in. These people don't play fair. It ain't even fair at the state fair. Give a young nigga gray hair. That's why I'm here. Make your ass lay there. You better stay there. Close your fucking eyes like it's daycare. Make myself clearer than Shakespeare. I'm here to take money, even fake hair. So desperate is what I'm left with. For the record, you affected. Who you elected is so septic. So full of shit, I can't accept it.
Arrest the president, arrest the president, arrest the president. You got the evidence. Arrest the president, arrest the president, arrest the president. You got the evidence. Arrest the president, arrest the president, arrest the president. You got the evidence. Arrest the president, arrest the president, arrest the president. You got the evidence.
I reside on the west side.
West side.
I murder with my third
eye.
Nigga so fly, get a bird's eye. I make them scream bloody murder. Let's meet at the White House. Run in and turn the lights out. Man, they treat it like a trap house,
yeah.
These motherfuckers never take the trash out.
Damn.
They just cash out and mash out. Nigga, take your drugs and pass out. Niggas love to go that fast route,
yeah.
I see you when your black ass get out. Homie, you play too much,
yeah.
Why these devils, they doing way too much.
Watch,
most of them won't say too much. Why they steady planning, God knows what.
God knows what.
That's why I roll with the real ones. Real ones trying to reach millions. Real ones trying to make billions. Real ones dressed like civilians.
Arrest the president, arrest the president, arrest the president. You got the evidence. Arrest the president, arrest the president, arrest the president. You got the evidence.
Arrest all of the criminals, the presidents, the imperialists, the capitalists, the Zionists, the neocolonists, all those who exploit humanity and that have committed crime against humanity. And speaking truth to power, welcome back to Africa on the Move and closing out this program, Power One, of a two-part series. What time it is? We're going to ask our political panelists and analysts 2 minutes and less to give their final remarks. Brother Moses. The final thoughts, Brother Moses. Okay, let's move.
Yes. I had it on mute. I couldn't get it off. I think, you know, that we have to unite the many to defeat the few. We have to recognize our common interests and pursue a united front against those who are opposed to our common interests. The history and hurried ages of apartheid in the USA show that, you know, we need to honor our mother and father by getting married before having children, and you know, we have to judge people by words and deeds and not just the color of their skin. We see that, you know, Donald Trump wants to go back in time to the good old days when the Civil War, and Netanyahu wants to go back to the good old days when Jews controlled Palestine. And so we have these reactionary movements. It's always the good old days they want to go back to. And, you know, it's time for thinking forward and not thinking backward. And that's why defense of the fatherland is what it's all about. And I'll leave it right there. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Moses. Sister Eleanor, 2 minutes or less, your final thoughts. Sister Eleanor.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hello?
Yes, we can. We can hear you.
Well, we see the famine and the difficulty happening across the Sahel and in Africa due to the environment, global warming. We see the death and mayhem and genocide in Sudan. But the greatest genocide we've seen in the 21st century or the 20th century has been the genocide of the Palestinians. And we all have to remember that. And that fascism is on the rise. And it's far more dangerous than imperialism. Donald Trump is a fascist. People that he uses now words that Joe McCarthy used in the 50s, not only Mussolini and Hitler, but we saw the outcome of the McCarthy movement and the deaths and the mayhem. And he's talking about the enemy within, meaning U.S. citizens. He called his own former attorney a U.S. A traitor within, Obama a traitor within. And he wants the military, if reelected, to fully enforce the laws against freedom of speech. And I take it in the stomach. But go ahead.
Thank you, Sister Moore, for your contribution to today's program. We'll go now to Brother Hackey. Your final thoughts, Brother Hackey.
Yes, Nick Quested, a documentary filmmaker who studied the January 6th insurrection, you wrote a very interesting piece in terms of the strategy or potential strategy used by the far right, facilitated by oligarchs, that's going to happen in the United States with respect to voting. You read out three central points. In terms of facilitating chaos, you talked about poll watchers creating the perfect pretext for false allegations against other poll watchers. Secondly, he talked about pressure on elected officials by use of armed protests outside of tabulation centers in swing states. And thirdly, he talked about lawsuits initiated by the state legislators refusing to certify electors. Eventually, you know, all of these tactics leads to one strategy. And that is to coerce the state politically to process Trump as the winner, or to facilitate mass chaos, forcing states to concede Trump is winner or face major disruptions to the state. So when we talk about this kind of strategy, you know, clearly we have to understand that a lot of things have taken place now, and we read about them, and we say, well, this doesn't make any sense. Why would these people do this, or why do these people do that? But it all has to do with the fact in terms of part of a broader strategy. And because this strategy is real, because these people have no faith in democracy, they're perfectly comfortable in terms of, you know, conniving and you know, creating conditions to justify massive chaos for the sole purpose in terms of winning an election. Having said that, Brother Afri, you know, one of the things that, you know, because this is a rally, and I tell people, listen, You got to unravel the matrix. We have to. Because the bottom line, despite what we might believe, whether or not we believe wholeheartedly in the system or not, the bottom line is the changes that are taking place in society adversely impacts the masses of African people in society. And if we don't fundamentally understand that, then what can we do in terms of preserving ourselves, you know, against this face, this overwhelming odds in terms of kind of potential violence and mayhem that's coming our way? We have much work to be done, and there is no other way to get around it. We need organizations, we need institutions. Without that, the situation for our people in the future becomes a grim one. So we got work to do. With that, I conclude.
And on that note, we'd like to thank all of our political panelists and analysts, our special guest, Sister Camille from Napa Roots Bookstore, and of course, you, the listening audience and supporters. For Long Africa, move to come to your homes today to speak truth to the powerful and the powerless. We would like to remind everyone that every Sunday evening at 7 p.m., you can come and join us and spread the word, help be our listenership. But more importantly, if you have something to say, something that is going on in your community, please contact us at africaonthemove2@gmail.com, and we welcome you to come on and share your information. Because after all, you must understand that without information, people cannot think. And without organization, they can't think clearly. Until next time, from Africa on the Move, let's continue to strive to go forward ever, backwards ever, backwards never, and remember, the solution to African people on a global basis, Pan-Africanism, is the key. Once achieved, it will set all Africans free. Until next time, I'm Brother Africa. This program is under the banner of the African Women's Association. And we will continue part two, What Time Is It? We thank you for listening.
So we have to fight, 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 fight against cruising, cross the border, shoot down women, cross the border, you take your mind, cross the border, some beats were right, we gonna fight. Majority rule, yeah. You need minority, but that could rule, yeah. So we gon' fight against the apartheid. We gonna fight against the apartheid. Break off from
so vast, so great, the African embrace.
When you give up yourself.
The color of life. Universal harmony. The earth supports our conscious effort for sustained humanity. Human beings, human love, on a spiritual tip,
an exchange from one
so vast,
to the other.
So great, the African embrace. Live beyond, love beyond. Your skin to where you belong.
Started a long time ago, and it wasn't a show. We gave birth to a style like a precocious child, feeling the passion for life, erasing away all the strife. Telling our tales with verbal mail, putting honey on the blade, creating language to persuade. Share who we've always been, always a blessing, never a sin. We are doo-wop and bebop and hip-hop, and we don't stop. Our mother gave birth to everyone on earth, so we echo her call, and always walk tall, cause we're hip to the world, so we create black pearls, that everyone can wear, that everyone can share. We can't live in despair, so we shine everywhere, on and on, on and on. On and on.
Africa.
guérir le monde. Le patriotisme, tout au froid, c'est mon fan noir. Kwame Nkrumah, le leader africain, André Bouin, oh, oh, oh. Malcolm X, nous disons non à la guerre, à la haine, au racisme, au tribalisme,
pour le développement
de notre continent, Afrique, le Congo, oh, oh, oh. Ouais, c'est de l'opé dans l'unité, dans le monde, la volonté, le vertu, Malaya Congo.
L'amour, la volonté et le sacrifice pour le changement du Congo. Congo Love pour un Congo nouveau. Madame Patricia Lokwa, servant. Banaya Congo Tolingana pour Sangana.
Africa, indeed, we are strong. Congo needs unity, we are strong. Africa, indeed, we are strong. Congo needs unity, we are strong.
Mukono watoto Afrika, watoto wa Kongo, tuache choki ubaguzi wa kabila, tuungane tupeane mawazo, ndo tutajenga nchi yetu Kongo, tuepuke vita, tukatae vita, chuki na fitina, ili Kongo yende mbele. Afrika nzima, mama, 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 eh, oh, nalelie, mama, eh,
Africa, we are strong, Congo need unity, we are strong, Africa, we are strong, Congo need unity,
feeling my flow. A girl from Wooded, they buy and they ready to go.
Go find me in the club.
Bottle full of bub, mama, I got what you need. If you need to fill a bar, I'm in the habit of sex, I ain't into making love. So come give me a hug, if you're in there getting rough. You can find me in the club. Bottle full of bub, mama, I got what you need. If you need to fill a bar, I'm in the habit of sex, I ain't into making love. So come give me a hug, if you're in there getting rough. My flow, my show brought me the dough. That brought me all my fancy things. My crib, my car, my clothes, my shoes. Look, homie, I done came up and I ain't changing. You should love it way more than you hate it. Oh, you mad? I trust that you be happy I made it. I'm that cat by the bar, toasting to the good life. Moved out the hood, now you tryna pull me back, guys. Too much on, get the pumping in the club, it's on. I'm with my eyes, the chick, till she's mad, she gone. Hit the roof on fire, man. Just let it burn up, just talking about money, homie, I ain't concerned. I'ma tell you what bank for me, cause go ahead, switch the style up. And if they hate, then let them hate, then watch the money pile up. Or we can go upside the head with a bottle of bub. Come on, they know where we be, you can find me in the club. Bottle full of bub, mama, I got what you need. If you need to fill a bar, I'm in the habit of sex, I ain't into making love. So come give me a hug, if you're in there getting rough. You can find me in the club, bottle full of bub.
When I was pregnant in jail, I thought I was going to have a baby and the baby would never be with me, but I was acquitted a month and 3 days before Tupac was born. I was real happy because I had a son.
When I was young, me and my mama had beef, 17 years old, kicked out on the street. Though back at the time, I never thought I'd see a face. Ain't a woman alive that could take my mama's place. Suspended from school, scared to go home. I was a fool with the big boys breaking all the rules. Shed tears with my baby sister. Over the years we was poor than other little kids. And even though we had different daddies, the same drama when things went wrong we blamed mama. I reminisce on the stress I caused. It was hell, hugging on my mama from a jail cell. And who thinking elementary? Hey, I see the penitentiary one day. Running from the police, that's right. Mama catch me, put a whoop into my backside. And even as a crack fiend, mama, you always was a black queen, mama. I finally understand, for a woman it ain't easy trying to raise a man. You always was committed, a poor single mother on welfare. Tell me how you did it, there's no way I can pay you back. But the plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it. Dear mama, now ain't nobody tell us it was fair. No love for my daddy cause the coward wasn't there. He passed away and I didn't cry, cause my anger wouldn't let me feel for a stranger. They say I'm wrong and I'm heartless, but all along I was looking for a father, he was gone. I hung around with the thugs, and even though they sold drugs, they showed a young brother love. I moved out, started really hanging. I needed money of my own, so I started slanging. I ain't guilty, cause even though I sell rocks, it feels good putting money in your mailbox. I love paying rent when the rent's due. I hope you got the diamond necklace that I sent to you. Cause when I was low, you was there for me. You never left me alone because you cared for me. And I can see you coming home after work late. You're in the kitchen trying to fix us a hot plate. Just working with the scraps you was given. And mama made miracles every Thanksgiving. But now the road got rough, you're alone. You're trying to raise two bad kids on your own. And there's no way I can pay you back. But my plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it.
Don't you know we love you,
sweetie? And dear mama,
please, no one above
you. You all appreciate it. Pour out some liquor and I reminisce. Cause through the drama I can always depend on my mama. And when it seems that I'm hopeless, you say the words that can get me back in focus. When I was sick as a little kid, to keep me happy there's no limit to the things you did. And all my childhood memories are full of all the sweet things you did for me. And even though I act crazy, I gotta thank the Lord that you made me. There are no words that can express how I feel. You never kept a secret, always stayed real. And I appreciate how you raised me, and all the extra love that you gave me.
I wish I could take the pain away. If you can make it through the night, there's a brighter day. Everything will be alright if you hold on. It's a struggle every day, gotta roll on. And there's no way I can pay you back, but my plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it.
Don't you know we love you,
dear mama.